Thanks very much for the kind and generous introduction. So I'm a little bit of an oddball out here because I am by training a physician and microbiologist and infectious disease researcher. And in the landscape of things that was introduced this morning, I would be the person that sort of deals with the terrorism after the fact when it happens, or we're concerned with what could we do for prevention. I literally have two bosses. One boss is the dean of the Biological Sciences Division at the University of Chicago, who is also the dean of the medical school. And my second boss is the director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, whom I'm accountable for as far as the Regional Center of Excellence is concerned, and that's an NIAID-funded initiative. And NIAID, of course, is a part of the National Institutes of Health. So the NIAID has established by now 10 regional centers of excellence, dividing the nation into 10 regions. And wherever there are stars, then these would be the administrative centers for individual regional centers of excellence. And in blue is what we call the Great Lakes Regional Center of Excellence, and Chicago is the center of that. These regional centers do not necessarily match with laboratory construction efforts of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, but they do match as far as Chicago is concerned. Now, to provide a little bit more detail about the Regional Center of Excellence, we are, of course, as a regional center, affiliated to some degree only with the states and with local authorities, but by and large we respond to federal initiatives. Now, it's a consortium that is formed from academic and research institutions, and it's a long list. That list has been expanded to 25, and you can see all the participating institutions listed on the right side. Why bother with such a long list of institutions, obviously? And the first thing that we found out is in order to establish a center of excellence that has a broad expertise in infectious diseases, it is literally impossible for any single institution to host scientists that basically represent the entire spectrum of infectious diseases. And in order to provide a basin that sort of siphons off the intellectual capacity of all these universities, that is why the regional centers of excellence were formed. And they communicate using state-of-the-art technologies on daily, weekly basis. We have national meetings, regional meetings, although I must admit that for regional meetings, we usually go to warm regions like Florida or North Carolina. I mean, I got to be a little bit fun of this as well. So Region 5 then encompasses Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Now, what are we supposed to do? And what we're supposed to do is shown on this slide. In the first place, we're supposed to do basic research on microbes, and without that, unfortunately, nothing could be done. And this is this one element that makes, I would say, funding agencies always very nervous. We tell them more and more about research, what there's to know about microbes, and you can imagine this. You, as a social scientist, will find out lots of things about social science that you find vastly amusing, but they may not be directly applicable, but they represent a very important foundation. That foundation is supposed to be translated into two products that we have to deliver and we're under scrutiny for, and those are vaccines. And in the case of infectious diseases, there's a very, as you probably know, there is an incredible intellectual opportunity first discovered in 1905, and that is that you can vaccinate an infectious disease and you can literally and physically take an infectious disease off the table by priming the host for immunity so that that host can no longer suffer from the disease. There's no such thing for cancer or any other disease, and this is something that is enabled exclusively by microbiological research. Now, the best therapeutics that are still on the market and have the greatest efficacy, so if the one dose shot that will cure an infectious disease, are in the realm of microbiology. And that is what's wanted, that therapies are available. It's a very interesting fact that in the United States in particular, there is no tolerance for infectious disease. If somebody suffers from an infectious disease or one of your beloved family members suffers from an infectious disease, you will run to the emergency room in full anticipation that that fever will go away in 3 hours and that you never ever have to go there again. And that is an incredible pressure on the infectious disease community, and that we are to deliver those two standards, therapies for any infectious disease and hopefully vaccines for anything that there is. Now, diagnostics, the regional centers of excellence are also involved in, but we're only involved in this as far as medical diagnostics is concerned. We are not involved in building detectors that are supposed to scan the environment for the release of microbes. That is something that falls into the hands of other federal agencies. Now, because much has changed, particularly through the U.S. Patriot Act and working with these microbes, and I surmise that you all do not work with these microbes, but for those that do work on those microbes, there's a lot of administrative work that needs to be done, a lot of security work that needs to be done as a response of 2001, and in order to do that, a vast expansion of research capacity had to be constructed and needs to be administered, and we're intimately involved in that. So before I go on here, I just want to say that rather than running through the litany of giving you my entire talk, I can be interrupted at just about any point. So if you have questions, please don't hesitate. The forum is small enough. You can stop me. It's not important that we go through all of these infectious diseases. I, of course, love them, but you may find specific sub-facts more interesting and want me to explore on that, and I'll gladly do this. Now, it's impossible to talk about all infectious diseases as a threat. CDC categorizes them as A, B, and C category agents. NIAID has its own list. It's also labeled A, B, and C. And then there are these new and emerging infectious diseases that pop up every year. Our field is not a static one. I don't know how that is in the field of explosives, but in the case of microbial pathogens, we discover on balance between 2 to 5 new pathogens per year. Some years are more fruitful than others, and say 10 or 20 new pathogens pop up. But that tells you that these pathogens that have never been seen before are discovered for the first time, are discovered as disease-causing agents, and their impact on society is by and large unknown and needs to be responded to. So there are emergencies in infectious disease, as can be amplified, say, by the SARS epidemic, but there are many others. Obviously, avian flu would be another one of those. Aside from this, NIAID has made a ranking of agents that are called A, B, and C. And the A-class agents, which are listed on this particular slide, as a column of diseases and the associated infectious agents that are responsible for the disease, is what we're supposed to find answers to in addition to everything else. So, for example, in the center that I lead here at the University of Chicago, there are about 12 different pathogens and diseases that are being studied. And we do work on all of the diseases that are listed here on this slide. Now, when you take a look at the diseases that are on this slide, they represent some very old, even biblical terms. I'm very interested in plague, and you probably know of the plague antiqua. They're responsible for plague in Justinian times and outbreak in Constantinople. So that would be very old. Anthrax referred to supposedly in dreams of Joseph in biblical times, and also a fairly old disease. Both of them are caused by bacterial pathogens. You may not know what that is, but I'll explain that briefly. Smallpox is a disease that you would even ask, why is it up there? After all, this is a case of the greatest victory of medicine, namely that a development of a vaccine that is as old as Jenna was applied to eradicate the disease and led to a toasting at the World Health Organization, and the disease was literally eliminated. One of the testimonies to the success of our field. But it's still up there, and I will explain why that is. Then there are new infectious agents that cause hemorrhagic fevers. They are the most deadly infections that are known to mankind, including Ebola and Marburg virus, and they emerged in Central Africa. These represent serious threats to society if they were to spread. And then we go to diseases that are endemic in large portions of the world, tularemia caused by Francisella tularensis, and botulism, an organism that is literally everywhere, even in this room, and gives rise to a disease that is by and large referred to as food poisoning. So what I want to do in the presentation is just give you 4 small vignettes. They give you a flavor for what an infectious disease is, what the agent is, where you find the agent, what could be a threat as far as society is concerned, is who could actually do this. Is it particularly difficult from a skill set to convert whatever I tell you here to a weapon, say? And what is it that you can, in the end, do about this? And without any questions, I guess away she goes. Now, before I go to the first infectious disease, which shall be smallpox, I want to tell you what we're working on then at the moment in the RCE as far as products is concerned. We're actively working on no less than 6 different vaccines, and I will tell you a little bit about them. Drugs is a very interesting chapter for people that are interested in this. Maybe they want to ask me at the end of the presentation, but it's much more challenging to find new drugs that are very good. And diagnostics, of course, I alluded to. Okay. Now, I should say before taking off here that we're constructing, and Kathleen mentioned that, a biosafety laboratory at Argonne National Laboratory, which will be completed 2007-2008. It's by and large a BSL-3 facility that allows work on several of these organisms that are listed, not hemorrhagic fever and smallpox, but it permits work on plague, anthrax, tularemia, and botulism. And the facility is about 45,000 square feet in size, and it will be located on the Argonne National Laboratory campus. All right, smallpox. Now, smallpox is a human disease. It is caused by a virus, and the virus itself requires a host cell to replicate. It doesn't replicate on its own. The causative agent for human smallpox is a virus called variola major. The diagnosis of smallpox as a disease is a diagnosis that is made by clinical inspection. You can easily see on the integument of this child that there are vesicles on the surface of the skin, and they uniformly have the same size. The entire integument is covered, and it's not just this integument. Epithelial cell surfaces and internal organs are also covered in the process of this disease. Now, the disease, other than the replication of this virus, the generation of more virus, and the spread of the virus by respiratory droplets or by direct contact, is all that is in the interest of the virus. What you must remember in the discussion of infectious agents is they have nothing against the host personally. They only care about becoming more viruses or bacteria, and that's sort of where it stops. There's no political agenda, it's just evolutionary pressure. And as Josh Lederberg assured me, in the end, the microbes will still be here when we'll long be gone. And as he said, I'm still surprised that we're actually still here, because on a numerical scale, considering how rapidly microbes replicate and how slowly it takes us, if I look at my own children, it's really a surprise that we still manage to be around. Now, in order to verify that this disease, which can barely not be confused with anything else, is, however, truly variola, there are additional tests that include electron microscopy, DNA, and antibody tests. Now, as I said, vaccination is a prevention of this. And what's actually interesting, as a therapy, even vaccination falls into place. One can vaccinate individuals that have been exposed and prevent the disease. Once the disease is as far progressed as this, vaccination will not help at all. There's a question of whether or not there is actually a therapy. Some people believe that immune globulin administration and cidofovir, a chemical inhibitor of viral replication, may be useful, but there is no evidence for that as of yet, simply because the disease is no longer around and the efficacy of those drugs could not be tested. Now, the associated mortality of smallpox is 30% for any one infected individual. Now, people that are exposed, by and large, will progress to develop the disease and will spread the disease unless they have been vaccinated. Yes?
How long would it take to find a vaccine if smallpox has been mutated?
I shall talk about this. This is a complicated question. You shall see in a couple of minutes. Let's hold that question for a second. Now, this shows you an electron microscopic picture of the organism. It's one of the largest viruses known. And its genome is made up of DNA. For those of you that are virus aficionados, you may know that we classify them according to the nucleic acids. They can have DNA or RNA. They can have segmented genomes or whole genomes. This is a linear, if not circular, genome, which is shown here. And the virus delivers this DNA blueprint into a cell, which is then subject to transcription and the generation of early and late messenger RNAs that give rise to protein products. There are hundreds of protein products in the case of the smallpox virus that in the end lead to the formation of what we call virus factories. And these virus factories spit out viruses that then emerge and give rise to the infectious particles that are released. In the process, the virus, you must remember, has an interest not to kill the host cell. We in fact call those microbes that kill either the host cell or the host cheaters. And that's an unfortunate event in the microbiological infection, because if you completely eliminate somebody, that means you eliminate your reservoir for replication. So this organism isn't really a cheater, because the associated mortality of 30% is admittedly fairly high, but it's low enough to permit replication and immunity, of course, in those individuals that have been infected, but then also spread of the organism. So it just has about the right balance. All right, now, I think this is a very important slide that shows you the pathogenesis of the organism, the clinical picture, the replication of the virus, as well as the appearance of oropharyngeal secretions that represent the infectious state of the individual. So following infection, there's an incubation period of about 10 to 11 days when nothing really happens. The day of the rash can begin just about here, and you can see the onset of the rash. However, the oropharyngeal secretions, that is the infectiousness of the individual, antedates the appearance of the clinical symptoms, which is to say that a person can infect other individuals before it is apparent that the individual suffers from smallpox. And that's a very important feature of smallpox. Now, later in the progression of the disease, the oropharyngeal secretions will go away. There's virus, of course, in the vesicles and can be transmitted by direct contact still. But importantly is then, you know, in case that there is healing, eventually there's antibody that is made, and this antibody is neutralizing, that is, it inactivates the virus, and those individuals that survive a smallpox infection will be immune to subsequent infections. Okay? So this is how the host made it, that you get smallpox only once. Now, what's really interesting is of course, that there are many smallpox viruses, if you wish, and every species on the face of this globe literally has its own smallpox virus or pox virus. And that is very important. Now, when I talk about smallpox and the eradication of smallpox, that refers to only the human smallpox virus, but doesn't say anything about any other smallpox virus. Now, as I said, the pox virus was eradicated, and in the United States, there's just two locations where the virus is being stored. It's being stored in other places around the world, but there's been great concern what would happen to our society where we stopped immunization with the vaccinia virus if the smallpox virus was released. And so the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, Donald Henderson conducted this simulation of a smallpox attack that you probably heard of, and named this exercise Dark Winter. So the exercise was the release of smallpox viruses with a spray bottle, something like that, in a shopping mall, and the numbers that are assigned to these three different stages represent the locations in the release of the virus and the number of infected individuals at the time of the release. So then the disease was followed from December 9th, 2002, until the 22nd. And you can now see that the smallpox epidemic would have been launched. The cases in many different states, and the cases, of course, have increased. The simulation occurred in the winter. The winter is more favorable for the transmission of smallpox because the desiccation of the respiratory airways give rise to an index case ratio, that is the ability of one infected individual to transmit the disease to 10 others. So that is the index case in the winter, 10, it's lower in the summer. Yeah?
Is it true all virus incubation periods are usually around 10 to 14
no.
days?
That happens to be this one. Every single pathogen has a unique incubation period. In some cases, it can be faster. In other cases, it can be longer. So at that point in time, the exercise, which was led by government officials and was under the impression that we did not have smallpox virus, led to a projection of what would happen. And that sort of shows you what happens here is the number of cases per day in the early days is, and the cumulative cases that would pile up. And I think I have one more slide on this. Yes. So the projections then were that if this began in December by, January 20th, 300,000 infected individuals, 100,000 people dead, and then in February, 3 million infected individuals and 1 million people suffering from that, assuming that mortality that I alluded to, namely 30%. That gives you sort of an idea what, of course, an epidemic would do if you do not implement or cannot implement quarantine. And if there's no countermeasure, say, as for example, vaccination. And this is a disease, smallpox, which spreads, however, fairly slowly. And I would say that if a vaccine is available, one could, of course, quarantine the individual cases and then vaccinate the surrounding population. And as a consequence, confine the outbreak to a minimum. Now, why play such intellectual games? That's really the question here. And obviously, from a DITRA perspective and social sciences, the question is, can the virus, which is present in several, maybe at least in one location worldwide, be purchased on the black market by a terrorist and be acquired? And I have nothing to say to that because I know nothing about it. But I can tell you a little bit about technology. But before I say that, I want to go back to the vaccination. After all, we made a vaccine. That vaccine is age old. What is it? It's actually a related pox virus from a different host. And the inoculation of the related pox virus into the integument of an individual leads to the formation of a single pox vesicle. And that active replication generates an immunity that is a cross immunity to other to the variola virus and to other pox viruses, which do, however, not play a role in people. So why not use this? And so one thing that's really interesting to me as a physician is the following fact, namely that our population has changed in the last 30 years. It was perfectly okay to vaccinate the American population 30 years ago, and it is no longer okay to do that. The reason for that is that the associated side effects of vaccination with the vaccinia virus, which led to the eradication of the smallpox disease, has side effects at about 1 in 1,000 that are relatively serious, and that would not be tolerated nowadays in the American population. The second problem is that Americans have changed. Americans have physically changed in the sense that the number of immune-suppressed individuals in the American population has dramatically increased as a consequence of the HIV epidemic, as a consequence of advances in cancer therapy and immune-suppressive therapy, and the fact that we are much older now than we were 30 years ago. Now, what happens is for individuals suffering from immunological diseases and immune suppression is a generalized a pox viral disease, much resembling smallpox, can affect individuals that have such immune suppression, and it can be lethal. And of course, you couldn't explain that to the general population that you should be vaccinated with the consequence of suffering a fatal vaccine side effect. There's no tolerance for that. There's actually no tolerance even for a single death in 100,000 vaccinees. That is how high the bar is for vaccines nowadays. Yeah.
When we vaccinated the military, I know all of us before we got vaccinated. What was the adverse effects? Was it 1 in 1,000?
For healthy individuals, yeah, it's largely the same. It's about 1 in 1,000. And you know, this would be considered actually a serious side effect, so a large spread of this. It can also be that people touch with an open wound a pox vesicle and then disseminate the virus to different locations. That's also a side effect. It can have serious fever and can be confined to bed rest. But by and large, these people will survive. I used to be vaccinated in yearly intervals. And the good news for those people is that have been vaccinated a lot. They have no side effects, not even skin symptoms anymore when they get repeat vaccinations. And some of you here may be vaccinated multiple times. Yeah.
Why would there be a need for vaccinations? Is there a longevity to the
vaccination? Well, so the current wisdom has it that people that have been vaccinated 30 years ago would by now have waning immunity and the antibody titers would be so low that they're not protected, at least not fully protected. Some of those people that have been vaccinated in the 70s may present with a full-blown disease and skin symptoms others may not. It is by and large believed that the disease would replicate in all of them, whether they developed a full disease or not. So the herd immunity by now is largely gone. Individuals that have been vaccinated as an adolescent and then received repeated vaccinations, their antibody titers are boosted and sky high, and they will, of course, be protected. It used to be that those individuals that are the examiners for smallpox would be vaccinated in yearly intervals for the reason of being completely protected. And this is why some of us were, you know, repeatedly vaccinated. I want to say a few words about a genome. So I already alluded to the fact that microbes have genomes and they're selfish elements they want to replicate. What you're looking at is a diagram that represents the viral genome. And so they have terminal helper loops and, a DNA molecule. And what's shown here in purple is the fact that the central conserved region of the virus is an element that is completely conserved. That is, you find that element in all pox viruses, whether it's a pox virus of a canary, of a sheep, of a crocodile, or you know whatever animal you may come up with. Now, the other elements in here that are in green, they're variable elements, and they, of course, differ. Now, the replication of this molecule can be artificially induced. What is important is that the variola genome has been sequenced, and that genome has been entered into the public domain. That is to say, the nucleic acid sequence for what is one of the deadliest human infections is publicly available. Now, is it in theory conceivable that you synthesize that genome and you engineer it to come back to life? And the answer to that very simple query is affirmative. One could do this. You had a question. No, I don't think it did. It just assumed that the herd immunity was so low that there was no significant effect in there. And it assumed that, the exercise stated that no vaccine was applied. So for that reason, you get the projections that would go up to 3 million cases. Now, as the technology that was developed by Bernie Moss at the NIH, which is that he can use a yeast artificial chromosome, which is an origin of replication for the replication of nucleic acid sequences in the yeast cell, that is brewer's yeast and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, this wonderful thing that we consume in after hours. And this thing you can now plunk into basically the genome for the vaccinia virus or any pox virus, and you can replicate the pox virus in the Saccharomyces cell. It's not that you care whether the Saccharomyces cell will develop little vesicles. The point here is that you can replicate the viral genome. If you take this nucleic acid sequence out of the yeast cell and stick this into a tissue culture cell, just a typical tissue culture cell, then one can make live virus out of that. I think that documents the technology, which is to say is that one can make a virus if one were to be skilled in the art from scratch and convert it to a living microbe. That technology is something that people have developed in the last 20 years. The DNA synthesis capabilities have been greatly accelerated, and now you can synthesize a stretch of DNA as long as 10 to 20,000 nucleotides in one single stretch, which is to say that one could synthesize a variola genome from 5 pieces of synthetic DNA and piece it back together. Now, monkeypox is, of course, a pox virus of monkeys. Now, the host restriction is a phenomenon of pox viruses and any virus. There is, however, in any host restriction, sort of a relaxed fashion. As a rule of thumb, I would say this, that for viruses, there's much greater host restriction than there is for bacterial pathogens. You'll see that in a minute. Now, monkeypox can be transmitted to people by direct contact, and this is a document of this. It shows an individual that has vesicles of the kind that are indistinguishable from those of smallpox, and they are, however, caused by monkeypox. Monkeypox occurred in the United States in the last few years. You probably heard this in the news media, and that is an example for the fact that another pox virus can enter what is now a human population without any immunity. Now, of course, pox viruses themselves are subject to mutation. Is that to say that because we conquered variola major and smallpox in the 70s, that the human race, if you wish, would be free of pox viruses for the next 10,000 years? And I don't want to be the dark angel of infectious diseases here, but I would guess to say, no. I think another virus can easily enter, can mutate, and then replicate once again in people. It would be a different pox virus, but pox viruses could, of course, enter again into human populations. So now, what needs to be done in order to protect against the disease that was eradicated? That seems almost ludicrous for a physician, but unfortunately, that is a reality. An improved attenuated vaccine must be generated that is safe in immune-suppressed individuals, and Bernie Mills himself actually has pioneered the research on a vaccine. It's a variant of the vaccinia virus, and that vaccine may be safe. The final word is certainly not in there. We are feverishly working actually on drugs with proven efficacy using animal models of smallpox replication and vaccinia replication, and there's several compounds that look fairly good. So I think there's certainly something to be offered here in the near future. Detection of pox viruses is something that I think DITRA and many agencies are interested in. And then I alluded to the evolution of pox viruses, and I would urge the scientific community very much to study that, because I think you basically study what will happen one day in the future. And with that, I was going to go to a completely different disease and illustrate something that's alive and around the globe, unless there are questions. So what you're alluding to is the fact that the immune system can be divided into two components, one that he refers to as an innate immune response and one that we call an acquired immune response. Vaccination and development of an antibody would be an acquired immune response. Innate immune responses are defense mechanisms that can kill a microbe when it enters a human host. All of you have microbes entering every single day, and they're killed by innate immune system. It's sort of a threshold level that prevents the onset of spurious infections. You find your neighbor, you know, a common cold phenomenon, is exposed to physical stress, has a reduction in innate immunity, and suffers an infection that you are protected against because of innate immunity. And there are adjuvants and several mechanisms that can boost innate immune functions. For the kinds of pathogens that I'm discussing here, innate immune functions isn't going to touch them. So this is much more for the true pathogens that we battle with every day, Streptococcus pyogenes, Staphylococcus aureus, rhinoviruses, enteroviruses, that will play an important role. But these are the organisms I discuss here, the cheetahs of the game. Now, plague is caused by an organism that we refer to as Yersinia pestis. The rules of engagement for this organism are completely different from that of smallpox. It's a bacterium. The bacterium's reservoir are animals, not people. Now, the animals that become infected and then harbor this bacterium for longer periods of life than people would. And these reservoir species are distributed around the globe. Now, this is a map that shows where you find these animals, and you can quickly see that you find them in the United States. It says here you don't find them in Mexico. That's not true. They're in Mexico, too. It's just a question of reporting. I'm not so sure whether they're in Greenland, but I'm positive that they're not in Australia. Yes, congratulations so far. Now, the United States acquired Yersinia pestis on a boat from China about 120 years ago. And the disease has spread throughout the United States and represents a reservoir. The disease is ubiquitous in Asia. It is in the former Soviet Union and many other countries. All right, now, the disease can be categorized into basically three phenomena. The first one is the transmission by a flea-borne vector that takes a blood meal from either an infected individual or an infected person and then bites a new host and releases, basically vomits the organism into the lesion of the skin. And that gives rise to a disease that we refer to as the bubonic plague. Now, in the bubonic plague, a bubo, which is nothing else but an enlarged lymph node in sewers, the location of the bubo is in close proximity to the flea bite. Now, the associated mortality of what we call bubonic plague is 50% and develops in a period of about 5 days. Those individuals that develop a bubu are infected and survive the infection are immune to Yersinia pestis infection. Those individuals that succumb obviously did not make that achievement. During the course of a plague infection, the organism replicates in the bloodstream and it must fulfill its destiny. Remember, the transmission, the intended transmission of the organism is a flea bite. The flea bite has a volume of 0.1 microliter. You may not think of that volume a lot. We have to pipette this in the laboratory. It's a very, very small volume. In terms of weight, it would be a nanogram. Now, in this flea bite of 0.1 microliter must be 10,000 plague bacteria. Otherwise, the transmission is not successful. So if you calculate that back, the organism achieves a density during its replication in the bloodstream of 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 colony-forming units, as we call it, per milliliter of blood. In other words, you're completely soaked in plague bacteria at the time that the disease is over, and the fleas would bite again and hop on. Now, during this replication in these different organ systems, the organism will replicate in the lung and then give rise to a secondary pneumonia. That secondary pneumonia can give rise to to respiratory-borne transmission of plague as an aerosol, and that disease we call pneumonic plague. If the organism is sensitive to antimicrobials, there is an antimicrobial group that can be used for therapy. It's the class of aminoglycosides, streptomycin and gentamicin, but it must be given early. If people already have 10 to the 10 plague bacilli in their blood, the antimicrobial therapy is useless. There is a prevention in the sense that antimicrobials can be offered to people that have been exposed to plague, but there is no licensed plague vaccine in the United States available, so there's nothing that at this point in time could protect people from the disease. Now, in the respiratory form of the pneumonia of the disease, respiratory droplets carry the organism into the lung where it replicates, give rise to a pneumonia and disseminated plague. The onset of the disease is much faster. It takes about 2 days. Associated mortality is 100% and gives rise to what we call the epidemic or pandemic form of plague. Pandemias or epidemics of plague occur in about 100 to 150 year intervals, or they can even take a 200 or 300 year interval. But remember, we refer to these epidemics as human epidemics. Epidemics in other animals' species occur all the time. And the epidemics in the United States, they by and large affect prairie dogs, which is a reservoir species in the United States with the highest incidence in states like Colorado and New Mexico. Now, the organism, of course, must be stored in a highly secure facility behind, you know, locked doors and top security systems. But please remember, if anybody is interested in finding the organism, they just have to take a trip to find some prairie dogs. And a study actually showed that folks want to sample the fleas of prairie dogs, they can find the organism in the fleas of the prairie dogs. And that was fascinating to learn that a flea can survive 2 years without a blood meal, allegedly, and remain infectious. So finding a flea is the name of the game at a university in the Southwest where undergraduate students sample using a cloth for attracting of the flea, the fleas of the prairie dogs, and can show that they're still infectious. And so the organism, I would say, is around. In different parts of the world, you're looking at different fleas and different species, so it's a very dynamic disease. Fascinating, really, from a microbiological perspective. This was also modeled. It was modeled because it's viewed as the most virulent, deadly bacterial pathogen there's around. And the top of exercises modeled plague. This was an interesting model. It was a release in a concert hall in Denver where the organism was sprayed into the audience. And then individuals on May 17 were infected, and because it was an aerosol, it was a pneumonic plague transmission model and gave rise to the following morbidity and mortality. These are now not months or whatever, these are just daily intervals. The disease was terminated because it was a federally run exercise, because it became apparent that the disease had already escaped the United States and antimicrobials weren't delivered appropriately. In other words, it was a very dangerous phenomenon. And to protect against plague is going to be one of the most challenging exercises there is. I want you to consider that in your modeling, because remember that the restrictions of getting the organism basically don't exist, since the organism is ubiquitously available. And as far as the generation of the weapon is concerned, this is just a liquid broth culture that was used here. Nothing fancy, no explosives, no whatever. Now, can you get immunity? So this to scientists might be an interesting phenomenon because we want to protect the general population, but it has a completely different interesting aspect to it, and that is that immune individuals, unlike suicide bombers, will not blow themselves up. Right? They could literally infect, you know, hundreds of thousands of people and walk away from it, not receiving any damage from the exposure to the pathogen. And fancy that, right? Now, I want to tell you a little bit about plague. So what you see on the right side is a PowerPoint appreciation for how the organism looks. And I spend most of my time studying this organism. It has three virulence plasmids. So these are DNA elements that encode virulence strategies. This fascinates me the most and gives rise to what is the most aggressive virulence strategy known in the literature. It's called type 3 secretion. What it really is a physician's syringe and needle. It actually really looks like that. It's just that this time it's not mounted at the end of a syringe, but it is mounted in a bacterium. And what you see in the bloodstream is these plague bacilli that replicate in the blood or in any tissue. Now, what does this thing do? Now, the needle delivers an immune suppressive protein that's called LCFV. And the first thing that it does is it suppresses the immune response through the release of a cytokine that instructs the host that everything is well. So our immune system has its own language, and when our infections are over, we release this thing called IL-10 to say, well, everything's peachy onky-dory, you can now go on vacation and relax. Now imagine that a microbe delivers that message to you. You basically, let your defenses down, and the organism just replicates inside of this host, right? And that is achieved through this type 3 pathway. The second thing that happens is that this needle injects into cells of the innate immune system that would be macrophages, neutrophils, and various cells that otherwise have the capacity to eat bacteria and kill them. And by injecting this needle and injecting these proteins in there, what the organism does is it kills every single one of the immune cells in a human or animal body. So at the time of the demise of that individual, the immune cells are literally gone. It's a phenomenon that's just unbelievable. Now, we in the field measure the virulence or the aggressiveness of an organism as the dose required to cause a lethal disease. And this can be exemplified in two numbers that I want to give you. The number for a commensal of people that called Staphylococcus aureus, it caused millions of infections, in an animal experiment is about 1 million to 10 million bacteria. The lethal dose for Yersinia pestis is one bacteria. And that single bacterium will kill the entire animal in a period of 3 to 4 days. Now, if you delete the genes for this particular needle structure, the dose required to kill that animal jumps from 1 to 1,000 million. The organism is literally completely avirulent. It's no more dangerous than a pussycat. Now, the beauty of this system is that this molecule that has immune suppressive properties sits at the end of the needle structure. This is this needle that I refer to, and at the end of it sits this molecule that has this property. Now, what you can do is you can purify that as a, you know, technology and modify it so that it's no longer immune suppressive, and we've done this, and this is this purple helix that has been removed. And then you can use this molecule as a vaccine. And what the vaccine does, I want to show you. If you immunize now an animal with this, purify a protein, and you challenge the animal with a virulent organism, then those animals that just are mock immunized succumb to the disease in 3 days, whereas the animals that are vaccinated with this vaccine are completely protected in an experiment that uses 1 million Yersinia pestis colorado 92 virulent organisms. So you can protect people if you wanted to. This is a technology that NIH and NIRD and we are trying to develop for use either in people as well as, I should say, laboratory workers, but they're also people. It might even be useful, of course, in animals, as you can see here, but that's not our intent. So there's certainly the possibility of protecting people. The problem, in the contrast to smallpox, is this: once a person has been exposed to Yersinia pestis, the time required for immunity is longer than the time required for disease. So unlike the smallpox exposure, it doesn't do anybody any good to vaccinate somebody against plague once they have been exposed. They have to be vaccinated before they're exposed with the organism. A very different scenario. So looking at the time, I think I'm still good. I'll give you two very small vignettes that sort of explain two other organisms and what they cause and why they have very unique features. And the point that I'm trying to make is, whenever you model something and you assume there's a threat, it's very important to take all the microbiological criteria into consideration, because they have very different behaviors, properties, and lifestyles. And unless there's an accurate modeling of the microbe, I think the results that you're going to achieve are going to be of limited value. Now, Bacillus anthracis is an organism that's, again, a bacterium. It's another cheater, in that it causes a mortality rate that is so high in people that it doesn't lead itself to a human reservoir species. The organism has a feature that's, again, different from anything else I discussed here. You must have heard about this. The organism forms spores. When the organism is in what we call the vegetative cells, it divides by binary fission. It elongates, creates a binary fission in the middle, and creates two daughter cells. And this is how the microbe replicates. Now, when the microbe runs out of steam and food, that is at the very end of infection, after it has killed a host, then the organism engages in what we call a developmental program that leads to the formation of a spore. That spore is generated by asymmetric cell division and the formation of an inert particle which is nurtured by a mother cell and in the end can be released into the environment. What is fascinating about Bacillus anthracis, as you know, is that the infectious form of this microbe is the spore and not the vegetative cell. And the transmission does not involve an arthropod like a flea. It, by and large, involves a dissemination of the spore, and in its natural form, it is a disease of herbivores. Now, why is that? And it turns out that when an animal is infected, the organism will replicate to extraordinary high numbers in this animal, similarly to plague. And when the animal dies, the organism is still in the vegetative state, and it requires weeks in order to form spores. Now, the decaying carcass of this animal contains these spores, which are then simply contaminating the soil. And another herbivore that comes by to graze on this contaminated soil will give rise to what is, in essence, a foodborne transmission of the disease. Now, there are three forms of the disease. I'll skip that first. This is what I wanted. There are three forms of the disease. The first one is called a cutaneous anthrax lesion, but in the pathogenesis, there's no distinction between cutaneous and gastrointestinal anthrax. So when the organism enters locally, it replicates in the skin and gives rise to a lesion that is called an Escher. This is not characteristic for anthrax. And this swelling here is associated with a lymphadenopathy. The organism multiplies in the lymph nodes. Typically, it would be submandibular. And then it has an associated mortality that approximately is 30%. And in individuals that can contain this infection, they will survive the disease, of course, and they will be immune to anthrax. Now, those individuals that cannot do that, they will succumb to the disease. In gastrointestinal anthrax, the disease is the same. The Escher would form in the intestinal cavity. The third form of the disease is respiratory anthrax, that is the weapons anthrax. And so people have come to the devious conclusion that these spores can be aerosolized and transmitted, and when they're respired into the lung, then they give rise to replication of the organism in the lung, and they lead to a rapidly fatal disease within 48 hours. Okay. So that is truly the weapons form. The other forms of anthrax are the naturally occurring form. There's just one example where this occurs in nature, this respiratory anthrax in people, and that's referred to as wool sorters disease, because people that work on the hides of infected animals can get that disease, but it's very rare. Now, once the organism invades, that is, a spore invades, it germinates and forms a vegetative bacterium inside of immune cells, lies the vacuole of those immune cells, and then replicates in the cytoplasm until it is eventually released, and from there on it replicates extracellularly. What you have to know about anthrax is the following. The killing portion of anthrax, and what distinguishes anthrax from its relatives, Bacillus cereus, Bacillus thuringiensis, by and large harmless organisms, is the secretion of a toxin that has three components called protective antigen, edema factor, and lethal factor. Now, the protective antigen binds to what we now refer to as the anthrax receptor, is processed by a protease, and forms a schlepper. The schlepper is essential for the transport of two toxin molecules, the edema factor and the lethal factor, into the cytoplasm. The lethal factor is a protease that cleaves MAP kinase, a signaling element of the innate immune system, and the edema factor increases the concentration of cyclic AMP, a second messenger in cells. These two phenomena kill the cell that has been intoxicated, and in the end, they will kill the host. The amazing finding is that antibodies against protective antigen block the entry of the toxins and provide protective immunity against anthrax disease. Current efforts of the federal government are to generate a recombinant protective antigen vaccine that protects people. Whether this actually protects against respiratory anthrax is still a contention. It's not documented. Now, in peripheral anthrax, that would be protective. However, the immunity can be improved if a second component is added to the vaccine, and that is the polyglutamic acid capsule. You have a question?
The vaccine we were given for being deployed.
AVA vaccine.
Right. Does that protect against both, or did it protect against the weapon?
Right. So the AVA vaccine affords protection. I've received it too. It's a terrible vaccine. What is that vaccine? Is a Bacillus anthracis variant that lacks the plasmid encoding for the capsule. And in the form that we receive, the organism basically released the toxin and lots of other molecules into the extracellular milieu, and this broth, if you wish, is precipitated by the company and emulsified and is offered as a vaccine. There are 6 injections required, and you require repeat boosters of it to keep the antibodies up. But we've tested this in the center at Battelle, and it generates protective immunity against respiratory anthrax in rabbits, and it generates protective immunity against cutaneous form of anthrax. So the vaccine does work. The vaccine, however, and that's a very important consequence of any vaccine, has a very bad reputation. And there are lots of people that refuse to have the vaccine. Actually, there has been a court juncture in the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy on the vaccine, as you probably know. It's very difficult to get it. I would say we're in vaccine limbo at the moment, because the RPA vaccine certainly does work. It's questionable how it will be administered and offered at this point in time. I think the vaccine research must go on. I think the perfect anthrax vaccine is still to be developed. My perfect vaccine would probably be a combination of recombinant protective antigen and the polyglutamic acid capsule, which is superior to recombinant protective antigen alone, but has the advantage of having purified component and minimal amount of toxicity associated with it. For all bacterial pathogens, there is information that is not available to NIAID researchers, but the information basically states that there are strains that have been generated, weaponized strains, that are resistant to commonly used antimicrobials. So that we must be prepared for scenarios that microbes are being used that are resistant to those antimicrobials, which would then put us in a position that we have no countermeasure against an individual infection. There's also a report that there can be evasion of protective immunity that is RPA-based, which is why I'm advocating 2 components to the vaccine. So now I just have, I'll skip this Sverdlovsk accident and what this actually means. The problem with anthrax is it lingers very long, so you have to protect for a very long time. And I want to get to this. So this, our center has worked on a lot. The organism Clostridium botulinum is ubiquitously present. I didn't say where anthrax was. It's found in the soil in various geographical locations around the world. It's much harder to get than Yersinia pestis, because the reason is that if you find it in the soil and you got to look for it, or if there's a disease outbreak, which is much more limited than plague, then one has to find it. Clostridium botulinum is completely different. The organism is everywhere. You can find it outside in the soil. You have to dig for it. The organism, in contrast to all the other ones, is an anaerobe. It only likes to replicate in tissues that are dead and have no oxygen. And that's different when you compare that to anthrax and plague. Why is that? The favorite strategy of the organism is this. It again forms spores. But in order to replicate, it needs to make vegetative cells and replicate in tissue. In order to do that, it likes to kill the host with a toxin first, so that the host is no longer perfused, and then the organism replicates in there, and once oxygen is exposed to the organism again sporulates, and then survives in the soil until the next host comes by. So there is hence a toxin, and that is called a Clostridium botulinum neurotoxin, and many animals are susceptible to that, and many animals serve as a reservoir for this particular type of disease. Now, the toxin is a protein molecule, and in the food poisoning category, it's taken up typically by oral ingestion. However, it can also be respired, although you need much larger quantities for that. Now, the diagnosis is provided by the patients themselves. They suffer a paralysis. The incredible phenomenon of this paralysis is that it lasts 6 months. And not all intoxicated individuals restore all the paralytic functions imposed by the toxin. Now, this feature enables medical research to use what we call Botox as a therapeutic. It's, of course, used for cosmetic purposes, but that is not interesting to me, but for various forms of spastic phenomena, the injection of the toxin is a useful therapeutic simply because it lasts so long. The problem with this now is if a person is intoxicated and suffers the paralysis and would suffer the consequence of that paralysis as a respiratory asphyxia, that person must be put on a respirator, but you must remember it must be put on a respirator for 6 months. So you basically count the countermeasure to botulinum neurotoxin as the number of respirators in the city. And it's a small number. So the moment that number is used up, there's no countermeasure that can awaken the motoric senses of paralyzed individuals. There is of yet no vaccine available, although our center has made a vaccine. The vaccine, because there's 7 different forms of the neurotoxin, must be a heptavalent vaccine that protects against all forms of Clostridium botulinum. Now, the toxin is a large molecule of 150,000 business end is a zinc protease. This is the slapper portion, and there's a little trigger built in there. It's like a bomb, if you wish. In its precursor form, the toxin is completely inactive. It must be cut here, and there's a disulfide bond form, which is reduced once the toxin enters its recipient cell. Now, this shows how this basically works. This is a nerve terminal. This is supposed to be the nerve terminal in the muscle cell. So this would be the presynaptic cleft, the synaptic cleft, and these vesicles that contain the transmitter information must fuse with the presynaptic membrane, release the contents of the synaptic transmission vesicles into the medium here, and are then taken up by receptors on the other side. And this is the informational piece, if you wish, the computational piece that tells your muscles that they have to move. Now, if this is defective, of course, you'll suffer complete paralysis. Not that there's anything wrong with the muscle, but because the muscle receives no information. Now, the incredible aspect of the Clostridium botulinum neurotoxin is that you ingest this, yet it paralyzes the entire motor apparatus in the spine. How that works, nobody knows. Some of the toxin is taken up in the intestine, maybe by nerve terminal endings, but how this works, we are clueless about. Now, as a result of this, the person is intoxicated. Intoxicated individuals are never immune because the amount required to generate immunity is so large, it would always kill the person. It is the most toxic molecule known to mankind. And is that the amount of 1 nanogram will kill, I forget, thousands of mice. It is a shocking thing, really. Now, in the case of an intoxicated individual, what really then happens is, so if we go back, there are these protein bridges that are formed between the vesicle and the membrane, and these protein bridges are cleaved by the toxin. And the toxin stays active inside of the neuronal cell and continues to cleave these proteins, which is why these cells do not recover for a period of 6 months. Vaccinated individuals will neutralize the toxin before it enters the neuron. Now, there is, of course, the possibility of injecting antibodies in intoxicated individuals, but what these antibodies will only do is neutralize extracellular toxin. They have no effect on the toxin inside of the neuron. So as a countermeasure, there's literally nothing but the respirator at this point in time, and there is no specific therapy to neutralize that toxin when it's inside. You have a question? Well, so different strains have different types of botulinum neurotoxin, and even in the different types, there are subdivisions that then have subtle changes. But by and large, there's cross-protection in the immune response if you immunize with the 7 neurotoxins, and to the best of our knowledge, that is at this point in time all-encompassing. What is the point of this? There are permutations of this. One of these permutations is the disease tetanus. You probably know that tetanus was the first Nobel Prize, or one of the first Nobel Prize ever awarded the underlying principle for toxicity and immunity, and an incredible success because we all receive tetanus toxin. It's a relative to botulinum neurotoxin, generates protective immunity that, you know, allows you to survive. The principle is the same. The only difference is that the Clostridium tetani infects actually to a small degree wounds, and then replicates in these wounds, but the toxin kills, the infection doesn't do anything. And the phenomena is a little different because the neurons are different. But other than that, it's the same principle. And it's very effective. This is how Clostridia stayed alive. So I'm at the end. So vaccine development is what's wanted here, and of course drugs that will inactivate intracellular toxin, and detection would be fun. The best detection system to date is the mouse. So that gives you an idea for how many mice it might take to provide adequate surveillance for the United States. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I hope you have a ton of fun at JTAC.